Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and subject matter experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human with over a decade doing AI stuff.
And joining us today is Subrata Mukherjee. He is going to talk to us about what is a data strategy and all the different components therein, why you should think about it no matter the size of the organization. Subrata, welcome. It's nice to have you on.
Yeah, same. Thank you, Sid and Lee, for giving me this opportunity to speak on this podcast. I know being very popular and being recommended by my colleagues to speak to you. So definitely love to give my thoughts on this one.
Yeah. And Subrata, you have done so many different things. We had a lot of fun talking about both your career and your ventures. And so if you don't mind, give the audience a little bit background. What are you doing today and why is this a passionate topic for you?
Yeah. So if you look at my trajectory, I've been like started my career as a developer. In fact, wasn't very early in the assembly language programming, bits and bytes, but eventually turned into a more of a emerging technology areas, and then I've been into system integration, being part of innovation lead, and then eventually with Microsoft, and now independently working on my own in multiple startups, supporting, advising, and also having been privileged to judge some of the AI startups to be part of a cohort where they could be as accelerator programs. So going through the entire journey, obviously data is very key element in any of this aspect. Like even if you look at the old traditional way and how do you kind of measure it, we were having data analytics those days with pure simple reports, which I know would take more time to develop them. And it has changed to more of you have a more sophisticated emerging data space where data has been also not only growing to extents of petabytes, terabytes of data coming in, which was not the case previously. We had smaller set of data. We were easy to manage with CSVs with Microsoft Access in the previous day. And Excel, obviously Excel is still there. But if you look at the whole trajectory of data and with AI now coming in play, and obviously AI is there for quite some time, but the flavor of AI changed with Gen AI coming in play. I think the data becomes most important and critical. It's a critical fuel for, I would say, the fuel of AI fire, right? So I would rather consider this as every enterprises has already been doing this, depending on where they are in the journey. I have seen where data was really siloed. Every organization, every department, and every team even had their own data sets. Even they have their own Excel files being shared, exchanged, but then moving from that journey towards a more centralized location, more moving towards from siloed to more into a centralized areas or even at least more organized front, because I think eventually those fed to the AI models and we could get a more meaningful insights, not in terms of AI only, but in terms of AI insights from analytics perspective.
Yeah.
So I think all of this comes into play very clearly as a key factor.
Well, and absolutely. And so, you know, when we were talking and we've had a couple of conversations now, and, you know, if you look at your LinkedIn, there's like a whole bunch of different aspects here. And so ChatGPT, Web 3.0, FinTech, startup, all of that, when we looked at, well, what might be the experiences that Subrata shares? And so the one that came out, and I think a thread that ties all of these aspects, all the many things that you do together, it's like, well, what does it mean to have a data-first strategy? And so, you know, what is it, you know, from your perspective, what is a data-first strategy and why should people have it?
Yeah, I think if you look at its the data-first strategy, right? Data-first strategy is, as I'm mentioning before, you are trying to organize your data in a right in a right structure, a right fashion, right? And it is basically looking at. I would say, take an analogy. I think if I don't know if somebody has presented before, look at the whole laundromat, right? Or a laundry cycle, right? You get a lot of different crumpled clothes and all, but you first clean them up, then you kind of iron it out. So I think the data strategy is similar. First of all, you need to identify your right set of data sources, obviously, and then you kind of collect them. And then you're right looking at how do you manage going forward those same set of data. And obviously, data is being so massively coming in. How do you kind of really streamline them? How do you have the right data structure in place? How do you have right infrastructure in place, right? And the next thing is like, how do you kind of go ahead and move and use that data correctly? So that is the very simplified data strategy. It's like making sure you have the right set of sources, you're making sure you have right set of automation or right set of infrastructure in place to collect and hold them. Then you have a right way to sort them out and the right way to kind of use them properly, right? That's a very simplified, I would say, strategy. And then looking at where the AI coming in more, I think that is where the fuel for the AI, as I was mentioning before, you have to use those data and high, obviously, quality of data. You have to take out the data that's not a good quality. And then obviously that will help you in effectively improving your AI effectiveness. You're enabling your predictive abilities. You have a more personalized experiences going forward based on that data. So I think that's what I would say, a very simplified manner that data has to be done in the right way, fashion for any organizations. Even startups is becoming more and more critical to have this in place.
I think that would be a nice framing here, because with a smaller company, it can be brought into sharp relief what is missing, right? Whereas in a larger organization, deficiencies or inefficiencies are a little easier to hide. And so that was one of the areas we talked about this first, was that, you know, a data first strategy should be inherent, incumbent, ingrained into startups. So what are some examples when you see, you know, ones that execute it well and think about it, and ones that don't, because you're working with startups, you're advising folks.
Yeah. So I think one I have seen executed well is they have already ingrained the whole ops, the data ops part of it. And they have used that at the very early beginning itself, right? So they have planned for it. They have created the exact amount of data sets they need, right sources of data set they need. And then they are looking at the infrastructure from the beginning itself, like how do we collect and store and use them? And right now you have so many tools available from infrastructure perspective, when from rather from the tools you are using day to day, you kind of, I have seen those startups who are heavily planned for it, and they have expertise that they have brought in people with those expertise skill sets of data elements or how to manage the data as the right go. And they have been doing the MVP using data elements itself to even win their investment part of it, right? And then I have seen at other startups who have not considered this fact, but they were more keen to get the outcome of based on their what they are trying to prove without having a full clear mind of data in their in the background. So I have been advising them to kind of look at the data set of the side. Look at if you're in your how you put the whole infrastructure in place and what kind of tools you're going to be using. I think there are a mix of both, but I love those companies who have already brought in data data engineers and data architects right in the beginning to even have a successful go run in the future.
So we had on the podcast last year one called Julia Barbnesser, who made the observation in her experience that the earlier you implement your, you know, data infrastructure, your data ops, your MDM, master data management, the cheaper it's going to be in the long term. Do you also find that with the startups that you advise?
Yes, yes. So I would not say all the startups will go for MDM. There are obviously some costs in part of it, but there are some, if you have to think about it, even the if you're not using an MDM tool as such, but you are going towards the direction of MDM. But we have already right now a lot of available cloud providers who are already providing you an embedded systems and services, which you can just turn on. And I think that's where you are already preparing for your standard connectors to your data sources. And you are having those intermediate from bronze, silver, and gold, the standard data architecture patterns. They are already able to follow them instead of going towards eventually they will to an MDM pattern or MDM overall MDM tools and overall MDM infrastructure. But I think they are putting the fundamentals in place because I think that's available more easily right now, which was not there. a lot of the cloud providers and other providers already providing you that capabilities. You're just turning them on and then just using it. So I think you're right. I think I would completely agree with you. That is a very key aspect, because that's what's going to be cheaper going forward. And if you don't do it right now, it's going to be more expensive in the future to do that.
Right. But then that's one of the other points that you made, is like the short-term versus the long-term needs. You know, where do you see, and again, it's fun to talk about this in the context of a startup, but a startup can be a microcosm of, you know, say a new venture or new team or new project inside a large organization. So, you know, the analogies work from that perspective. But the short-term and long-term needs, how do you see people balancing them well when thinking about their data strategy? And what kind of advice do you give startups when it comes to that?
Yeah, so I think excellent point. Like, if you look at it, short-term, you're right. But many startups can't afford to even have a lot of sources available at this point of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have to either spend time and cycles, which we have known a lot of the things we are seeing right now in the ChatGPT world. They will not have, either they have to negotiate hard, or they have to go and pay a lot of money for the data they would like to introduce or help use going forward. I think it's more of a prioritizing it, right? Like, what is your MVP look like? What is your initial goal look like? And then identifying the right data, or picking up the right set of data, which is cost effective for you at this point of time. And also putting a roadmap, a long-term roadmap for what is your, which you will go and start trying to work on the acquisition of the data. That will be a key aspect going forward. I think it's more of identifying the right use cases for your data to come in for now. And then looking at putting your checkboxes and putting your planning that, okay, I want to go and get the acquisition of this data sources going forward. You can start, because they are already starting the discussion with them, but it could be like in a plan, go to in a longer plan.
I think that, and frequently I can see customers make this mistake, and let me just be real, and myself too, right? Like, you know, we loathe to plan sometimes, because it feels there can be a certain measure, at least for me, and I think others like this, certain measure of anxiety putting a whole bunch of things on the list, because I want to go check the things off the list once I put it on the list. But there's a goodness in having that list, even though you know you're not going to get to all of it right away.
Yeah.
You know, because like I think we were mentioning this earlier, so if you go in and you're a startup, and if you at least know your priorities and what you need to do, and then you go to that next investor meeting, you're like, yep, I know we're not doing that right now.
Yep.
It's on the list. And here's why. Here's how we made the decisions. That conversation goes a lot better than just saying, we thought about it.
Yes.
Okay. But really, where's your proof you thought about it? If it's nowhere in your plan, did you really think about it? Or are you just answering that, yes, we thought about it right now in the moment?
Yeah. I think you're right. So I think if you look at when you're going to investors, if you really give a clear plan, that this is the reason I did not use the data sources now, or we have an active plan for it, I think that will really gel well with them. And now these investors are very, very clear on asking questions. I'm not sure everyone, but I think a lot of them are actually opened up their mind in terms of privileges or long-term legal issues or any of those governance issues. They're asking those questions in this point of time.
Lee, go for it.
Which also might be why you might say, hey, we aren't using this because of this reason, right? You know, yeah, this isn't on our plan because, you know, we saw there were some legal issues that, you know, we honestly don't have the money, time, or effort to deal with.
That's right.
Or you can just end up being very productive conversations, because if the team says, this is why we prioritize this way, we want to get to that, and the investor says, okay, that's great, but if I'm going to come to the table, because most of the time investors are coming with more than just money, right?
Yes.
They become with a reframing that says your priorities would change should we work together, right?
Right.
And so then you can have that very informed discussion on both sides.
I'm just giving a reference back for even the enterprise, being part of the enterprise a long time. I was part of this organization as a consumer healthcare organization, GlaxoSmithKline. And I think what I'm saying is that we had situations where we had to wait for a legal approval to use the data, right?
Mm-hmm.
To go through, because we have a consumer healthcare, we had a pharma team, And there was a lot of federal regulations of even cross-pollinating data. So we had to make sure we get clearances and clarity. But we kept them in our list of data sources to be added till we get the clarity and clearances from our legal team. I think the same thing that goes with the startups, right? You can still continue to build your models. We were still building our models. We knew if we can get this additional sources, we can still improve it, but it doesn't stop our work. We didn't stop our work kind of thing. That's the same thing applies to startups that, as you all mentioned, that you can still continue to do your work. You have to prioritize and find out the ones that can really help you to do the first level of your development and then go to the next level.
You mentioned something just now and then right before that. So you said the word that most people run and hide under a rock, governance, but then mentioned, you know, the innovation that you were trying to do or did at Glaxo, but had to get permission for. And so that kind of goes into the second arc of what we, you know, this data first strategy and something that's frequently overlooked, which is compliance and governance, right? So how do we turn compliance and governance into our friend for innovation, you know, versus the enemy? So you talked a little bit about things like, hey, there's challenges in acquiring funding. We want to avoid lawsuits. These are all things that like can hamstring both the startup and, you know, your corporate ventures.
Right. So I think, this is where your MDM, data hierarchy, lineage, and all those terms come into very play, right? Obviously, you won't have the privilege as your startup to have an entire compliance and governance team, right? So I think I would, what I'm recommending, and I think people in this world should look at, and obviously the corporates have a bigger set of people. I would say not like they have a vast pool of people, but they have a good set of people to kind of oversee you, help in terms of compliance and governance. I think this is exactly an area where startups also have to look at. They will not have the privilege, I would say, or funds to have a completely big set of compliance and governance team, but they can have someone with expertise to be hired as a fractional element where they can, or even take some kind of oversight from certain companies who are good in this niche area as part of your oversight board. I think they can just review it. You don't have to have a full-time engagement because this is something which you get a framework ready, you have approval or at least have, or if you have someone who has done this before into your team, that would be a good help. Or you, as I mentioned, we always recommend a fractional person to come in and join and help them out to set the state framework. And then you follow it up and every periodically, a few months later down the line, you have a review done. So you are already in that model, a mode where you are ready for that when actually the term comes and when you are also, obviously, having your funding in your next series round or in the future series round, you can have a dedicated personnel or team for that purposes.
Yeah. And I think something else that we, when we were talking about this before to bring back up is that compliance and governance wants a mindset, right? So you don't always have to have the people, I'm just doing the plus sign or the thumbs up emoji. You don't always have to have individual people. It's the mindset piece.
Yes.
Because this is also, if a startup thinks about these concerns, one, it helps avoid lawsuits. But as you set out, you know, the investors are looking for two things, the opportunity and then reducing the risk to pursue that opportunity. So if you have thought about these things, as you mentioned before, it's like you show up very well to that investor meeting, but also even internally, like having mapped to the outcomes, if you're in a large, there can be a complacency in larger organizations to not think about this because like, oh, that's somebody else. Somebody else has got this. It's somebody else's problem. Like, no, you're the one, you're on the team. You're building this. You have to have this mindset. You can't just think somebody else has it handled. What are some of the other things that you see or advising companies on the compliance and governance piece when you're helping the startups that you're working with today or ones that you've helped in the past?
I think, as I mentioned, I have not done an extremely big job, I would say, in compliance and governance, but
yes,
this is a standard recommendation I would give that you have to have a framework in place, right? Mm-hmm. As I was mentioning before, the data lineage, your data governance, data maintenance. So I think over that series, And as soon as you have a framework in place, I think just follow the framework, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a periodically, you can keep on having those being reviewed by an external entity. Then that will be a sounding board for you. And as that's the main thing. I haven't not extensively spent a lot of time on that part for them, but given the framework and given the areas, and I'd always expect them to continue to follow that model.
Yeah. And you know, and I can't believe that we forgot to mention this in the first section when we're talking about data first strategy, but you know, we were mentioned that this was a big thing both on data strategy, but then on the compliance and governance, and why we even said about that is that the hot topic today, right? Like everybody now is an AI company. So just like we talked about, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, every software is eating the world. Every company is a software company. You know, now today, you know, every company is an AI company. And so one of the pieces in talking about this data first strategy and even getting the compliance and governance is that, you know, a data first strategy is an AI strategy, right?
Sure.
So if you could for folks, like link those two, because I think that underlines the importance of the data first strategy and then also what we're talking about on the governance piece. So what is it to you that the data first strategy is an AI strategy?
Yeah, if you, as I mentioned in the beginning, right, like if you're looking at an AI first strategy, which is kind of becoming a more prevalent and everybody is talking about it, right, you have to understand that without data, AI will not be successful, right? Now, you know, with the Gen AI, you have large models, it has a lot of things ingested, already giving you a lot of answers, but right now you're going to start using it for your own organization. You still need data. You have to have either retrieval augmented generation or fine tuning. That still needs the data for it, right? So I think if you are going into the newer world of AI for strategy, data comes along with it, right? It is one of the critical element. And as I was mentioning, the fuel for the whole AI fire, right? So I think they are both connected to some extent, or to all extent, I would say. Mm-hmm. So from an AI perspective and data perspective, you need to have, as I mentioned, right, leverage the whole quality data foundation. You need to have a proper value from unstructured data, which is becoming a more and more prevalent with Gen AI coming in play. And then obviously you have to have your stages, different stages defined for those data sets. And then the most important part is if you have to have more optimized infrastructure and very cost-effective infrastructure in place. So all of this, which is if you wrap around with the data as your key element, tie them up, the data is there everywhere. And then data will help you to get to the AI world more in a better way. I think it's, I would say, more of a better personalized experiences, better predictive models. Without data, you cannot even do it. Simple as that. And the right quality of data. I think that they're all part of the whole factors, I would say, in this perspective. I don't know if that answered the question more correctly.
Or no, it did. Well, and I think the, you know, when we look at making these systems more and more complex, right, I think, you know, going back to even some of the earlier things in the data science space, just like, let's just take forecasting, right?
Yep.
Like forecasting, if you wanted to explain what the model did in the forecasting, it would actually be relatively straightforward. You had input data, you had math, and then you had the forecast. So there was a lot of traceability in what that answer was. Yes. These systems are, you know, not only are the individual components of the system like my LLM, or, you know, the vision models, OCR, like now I am taking highly complex things and then stringing all of it together. And so now, you know, the complexity just amplifies at each step.
Yeah.
And so my bias is like the data, you know, the classic data engineer in the room is like, well, the first thing that you need to be able to explain is the inputs. And the first thing you need to be attest to is the inputs, right? Like it does make sense, you know, from a food perspective, a food analogy, right? Like I want to know, you know, do I have high quality inputs and high quality ingredients going into that cake that I'm going to bake? So it seems like the same thing here. And that to me is something that is oft skipped. So.
Right, right. And I think one more thing I want to add here is, as you rightly said, the right ingredients. And now with Gen AI being prevalent, even people think about Gen AI, you just throw up a bunch of unstructured data. You don't have to worry about it. I think that's still not the case. If you look at the human feedback, becomes a very critical aspect of it. So even if you look at how ChatGPT was trained, it was all having human feedback to it, right? Your rewards and rewards model as part of the human feedback. So I think, as you rightly said, is not only having the defining the right data sources, labeling annotation becomes extremely important in this current world also, which was also there. In the predictive model, we had built predictive models, which we had a 3 year of historical data. Sometimes we had two, depending on how we do it. We had spent a lot of time in defining it, labeling it, feature engineering it, and all of that. But that changed now with generative AI. But I would say still the labeling annotation becomes a very critical part of your generative AI infrastructure. And I think the bias, right? If you look at the what happened to recently Gemini, annotations, how do you avoid biases in place? How do you avoid multiple things in place? Becomes critical for any, even for enterprises, even for startups who is building a product going forward down the line. So yeah, I think they're all key part of it.
Interesting thing here, though, is, and one of the big changes that's come in the last, you know, sort of 3 to 4 years is people just pulling models almost off the shelf, right? Prior to that, people would build their own models on their own data. You know, you'd have, even if the in models workings were a bit of a black box, you at least had all the traceability from A to B. Well, now if you are using, you know, you mentioned Gemini, you know, OpenAI, Mistral, Claude, whichever one you're using, you as the end user actually don't know how that was built, really, right? They're not, you know, releasing their data sets. Parts of them are, we know, common core that's commonly used.
Yeah.
But you don't know how they've manipulated that, how they've changed it. You know, with Gemini, it produces these images, but you don't control it as the end user. How do you kind of bring together those pieces where, you know, we want to have good data and stuff and use it as well, but we're also federating control of these things in many ways out to startups or large tech companies?
Yeah, very interesting question, right? So I think it all depends on the use cases somebody's building it out. I'm looking in terms of an enterprises, if they are customer-facing solutions using GenAI, they have to be clearly defining on how they want to use those models, right? If they want to use an open source instead of a closed source, because now they will have a more clarity of data sources to think about it, the parameters, the weights, it's very clear to them. Or if you are looking at internal facing ones and low hanging fruits where it is not impacting for you for legally, which you are not giving out a recommendation to outside world, you need to have a traceability. You don't need to have that kind of a traceability. Even you're just more of internal use cases for your workflow augmentation, right? Your co-pilots, your data sets. Even there's some errors in there, or if you don't see right data, you can have a way to say like, dislike, and then can still refine internally. For an external consumer facing one, with you're giving an interaction, we've seen a lot of issues happening for some of the companies. I think that's where I was mentioning is any model you pick or any of the model you build has to have a traceability, or at least it has to have some kind of a control in place. And even if you are refining and fine-tuning it, you need to keep your own data, which is being labeled, annotated properly, and have at least they try to do the best they can on that testing purposes so that you are really coming out with good outcomes to that.
Yeah. And then one of the other things in like that data first strategy, a key piece, and I think the labeling and the annotation comment you made kind of weighs into this next, this third arc to the conversation that, well, actually, no. Yeah. The third arc, three out of four, that you'd suggested, which is data ops. So how does data ops, let me lead with one observation and that goes into this, like labeling, annotation, other things like that. And there's many other things like that, that people, I have seen customers frequently forget to version, to make part of, so that if I wanted to go back and replay or look at the history of things, right, that history of, you know, what decisions were made about, you know, the model, the scoring of that model, the scoring of the outputs, labeling that I might have done, the data that input, those things can get lost over time, because people don't take that data first strategy, because it's not just the data I have, but it's also the data about what I'm doing with things along the way. And so you mentioned data ops as something that's very important. So the term is thrown around a lot. What does this mean? What are you advising folks that data ops means?
Yeah, I think I would say typically people are very understanding about DevOps, right? It's a very prevalently used term, right? Where you develop, build, test, deploy, and run, right? You have a process in place. You have thing in place. I think data ops is, I think, the similar line. You are now coming and thinking about a data kitchen, right? You're like, in terms of whole background process going on, where you have a clear of a sandbox, you have a development cycle. Again, they are, if you are developing an application, a solution, or a product which you're coming out, you have to have a parallel mapped thing for a data side of the house. You're like taking the entire set of process in place. Like example, when we were building this demand forecasting model while in my consumer healthcare company, we would get data sets from multiple sources, external data sources, and then periodically they would not be available, or periodically there's a something introduced in it, or they were, the format got changed. Again, it was not informed, right? So I think when you're looking at the terms of DevOps, you are looking at data ops in this case, you are not only thinking about pure just data management, now you're looking at the entire process from your develop orchestration, from testing, deployment, obviously, and monitoring and observability, right? So if you look at the whole different sections and automation right now with so much data coming in, how do you automate it? And there's a triggers when there's automation fails, or there are some issues in the insights coming out. So this whole process is that I would say is a data ops. Again, there is different factors, different definitions to it, right? I think it's about just putting a set of framework or management and process around it is data ops, I would say. And you are looking at it carefully, looking at it, monitoring it, looking at triggers, looking at notifications where the whole process does not go correctly. You go and intervene, right? You are looking at manually inspecting it sometimes, certain times, as the way you do any manufacturing facility. When you are creating a product, you have your manufacturing assembly line where you have QAs, you have things going on if something batch fails out. So those are the part of data ops happening. I think it has to be in parallel with DevOps and ML ops coming in now with LLM ops coming in, all the ops in the world. It's an interesting cycle, but eventually, fundamentally, they're all interconnected. They're all part of our process. You just have to set them up correctly and then have a monitoring and observability on it.
I wonder at one point, you know, we're going to move to a different term, right? Because when the whole DevOps movement started, and then everybody's like, well, no, wait, DevSecOps. And then it was like DevSec, and I'm like, I insert everything. And it's like, everybody's like, all right, we're tired of insertions because now this has become, you know, oxycillococcinum, right? It's just, it's like huge word. We're not a short. So then it was star ops, and you know, and now we have data ops, LLM ops, Gen AI.
Or you know,
ops,
just follow the chemists. You know, I mean, you're in chemistry. You know, we have, you know, chemical names that are, you know, hundreds of letters long, just because it, you know, we've got, you know, we'll put some numbers in there, and this is, you know, 1,2-dihydroxy.
So we need a periodic table of all the ops.
All the ops. Yes. Yeah.
Periodic table of all the ops.
Yeah.
But so we talked a little bit about how this is different than DevOps, right? And I think there's some key things to try to. So when you are coaching some folks around data ops and what it means, how do you get folks excited about it? Because the biggest thing I see when we're talking to customers, that have a good pattern of doing DevOps, it requires a couple of shifts that can be harder for people, particularly because data, you start dealing in shades of gray. If I'm writing unit tests around a web form or an app or something like that, it's like, can the customer open this? Can the customer log in? Can they input this stuff? Do they see this screen, right? That's easy. Now we're talking about, you know, it's much harder to look at. It's like, well, do I have the right distribution of data going in so that this forecasting chart that the CEO is going to look at? And then how do I know that forecasting chart's right? Like, I can see the data's there. I can see a distribution's there. Is it the right distribution? Is this going to be what the CEO is expecting? Do it. So there's a lot when we talk about, you know, observability on the pipeline. It's very different than just, did my code compile? Now, did the test pass? Did the functional test pass? Did the end user test pass? So how do you help people define it so people understand it and feel like it's less scary? And how do you help coach them along?
Yeah, so honestly, I have not specifically coached on a data ops kind of thing. It's the overall whole development cycle, right? It's like DevOps part of it and data ops part of it. But it's an interesting question. If you look at the organizational perspective, now they have a chief data officer, right? And you have a data directors, data. So their whole reason for that whole enterprise-wide when they are creating this role is now they have at least a very specific focus team looking at the data quality to data management and everything, right? Now, startups won't have a privilege or I would call it luxury of having a separate data officer and everything like that, right? So I think that's where if you are building a product, if you're building a solution, you need to have a data engineer. Obviously, that's part of your whole build cycle we recommend them to have. And obviously, putting this whole pipeline automation in place or at least a person to monitor it. So what we are looking at and telling them is that when you are having a quality team or a test engineers and all, they look at both. And an SME who understands the data well has to go and make sure he or she is embedded in that whole cycle to monitor, right? And then if you, as I was mentioning, is the right triggers, you don't can't look at every set of data. Like we had terabytes of data coming in my previous operations, right? We're from external sources. If the pipeline breaks down, at what point of time it broken down, right? You need to start getting those triggers and then have to reconcile. I think those if you look at the whole, if you start putting in better automation, better triggers, I think that minimizing for startups to have tons of people to have spent time on that, right?
Yeah.
You're looking at reports, you're looking at your the failure message and pinpointing to the right place where this happened. And then what are the mitigating steps they can take to do that? And we had to put those in place for that. And then interacting back with the SME. So I would say at least from a startup perspective, they need to have an SME who can play the role of a data quality analyst also, right? Who understands the data reports and sites. And then help the test quality engineer who can be a data test quality engineer also at this point of time. But right now, the privilege and luxury is not there when you are early stage startups. When you grow up, the Series A, obviously, you need to have a team dedicated for data, which is very critical going forward to monitor that. So I think it's a mix of both scenarios.
Yeah, and I love what you're talking about because it's building the mindset in, even if that mindset has to be shared among several people before you can have full-time roles for it. So there's a theme to tie together here as we go into like the fourth and final thing on the last set, right? So we talked about data-first strategy, compliance and governance, data ops. And one of the reasons that we on the Data Culture Podcast are fans of these topics, because it's all about being good stewards, good citizens, and building like these are components of a strong culture. And so now this last piece and why this is important is not only from the things you mentioned earlier, Shibota, around this is how you get funding, this is how you do customers, but there's a social contract piece, which leads into further goodwill that you build with a customer, further goodwill that you build with investors. So all of those prior three things help to be a good citizen in this kind of global economy and global and. So, but why the social contract piece? Like how did you were keen to talk about it? Like, how do you frame up like the importance of good data stewardship and having a data first strategy? Why did you want to talk? There's several threads there, but why did you want to talk about it?
Yeah. So if you look at it right, that if eventually you need to have your consents, you have your privacy and consents, which is a key aspect of it, right? You don't want to build out something which you never had a consent for, right? Down the line, you are having a trouble for it, right? To even justify it, as you were mentioning about the lineage, about what kind of data went into that place, right? So that is very important. At the same time, transparency and accountability, right? You have to be there. And then obviously fairness coming in play, responsible AI, which we're talking a lot about it more. So I think the social contract is eventually you are dishing out something, a nice dish to our consumers, right? But either the dish is tainted or the dish has poor quality ingredients or you have sourced it from somewhere which is real troublesome. I think those are key aspects of a social contract. Your product is not consumed by consumers, which is a part of we are the consumers also, right, of the data set. So I would like to get a product. It has to be a reputed product, obviously. There is not taints in it or contamination in it or not something which we thought that being forcefully acquired or had been under the gun to acquire the data. It's not the case. There are where you are not aware of it, or you are didn't get a clarity of it, or you didn't have a right amount of due diligence done. But you can go back and correct them if possible. And LLM world becomes difficult once the model is built. That's where you are more critical. But I think if you look at non-LLM or any other data sources you are building, even for before you feed to LLM, if you have those transparency, if you have the fairness, if you have the clarity, if you have the part of it, I think your consensus is there. You have the records for consents, right? Your eventual thing is not more problematic going forward. So that's where I think the social contract becomes very key of this. And we are seeing that issue happening right now with some of the lawsuits against the bigger players for the models they have come out. I guess they'll be sorting them out eventually, but it is a part of the social contract. I think we were discussing last time when we talked about it. So.
But at the same time, we are seeing a lot of, especially this last round of layoffs this last year, a lot of the big firms have actually been laying off their responsible AI teams, right? Those are teams that are many firms, you know, many, many big tech firms and mid-sized tech firms have been laid off first. What are you seeing an appetite from startups to fill that gap around responsible AI, or is it something people you think see as an extra cost they'd rather not have? Where do you kind of see people falling onto that spectrum?
I think to be practical and honest, startups will not have a dedicated set of lot of people for responsible AI. They don't have the privilege. They don't have the at this point of time, right? They don't have the luxury, I would say. But as you said, the mindset, right? As long as you have the mindset and the framework in place, and then I would say again for startups to have some experts being hired on a fractional basis, which is what I would recommend or even bring in experts, even smaller firms like experts. I would say if they have laid off those people from money company, bigger companies, they may be all looking for work. So they can also work fractionally to support a lot of startups in this space. And I think if you welcome them, and I'm sure many of them will be doing it, to have an oversight, right? And I'm myself very interested in this whole responsible AI. I've been kind of helping some of my ex-colleagues also kind of getting up to the speed and then see, hey, because this is needed, right? For any product you have, if you're buying from the shelf, you look at the brand, you look at the quality, right? And they have gone through a lot of quality checks, be a pharma product, be a consumer product. I think, and then nowadays, if you look at even the funding, a lot of the funding that's happening is for green tech and all the things, right? You are looking at responsible products coming out of the market. So same thing with data and AI will be a part of play going forward.
And I, foodie, so I love drawing the food analogy because I think there, so yes, without the lineage and the understanding, there can be a quality problem. But also you can still, like a lot, many of these things are of high quality, right? And so it actually isn't a concern, or not with all of them. So sometimes it's a concern of the quality, but sometimes it is high quality. It's like I'm the chicken I just got and I'm putting my plate together. It's great. Like it's fantastic. It's healthy. It's great. Tastes fantastic. But it's really then a question on the lineage, the sourcing of that. And so just as we've seen in the food industry and our groceries, many more people are concerned with how was this sourced? How was this raised? Was this treated humanely? Am I getting food from, you know, places where the farmers are being treated fairly, or is it becoming that they're being taken advantage of? So we're not all the way there, but people are much more aware of these things than they were before. And so I think to your point, it's a good, you can have like startups with good intentions, startups with a good moral compass, and still without these questions or these ideas, make mistakes that could be deemed as ethics problems because they don't, like the sourcing, that lineage information, you know, around all parts in the chain may not be known or easily known. And they also just might not know to ask the question.
So I think it's a very valid point. Like if you look at, and I have worked on this area also for provenance of data, or not data only, provenance of products, right? Which is the blockchain world, completely different world. And a lot of companies are doing it from a food perspective, a manufacturing perspective. I think I was thinking about it. Why not the same provenance of data for data, right? How can we have the provenance of data being kind of identified, which is easy to do for not only a software product, but any other products who are using AI. Like there's a lot of good ways to set the provenance in place and tracking in place and the sourcing in place, right? And then looking at the way a lot of this provenance is there, you have a scan code, you know the entire trajectory of where the whole thing came from, where it's being sourced from. And if consumers are getting more and more interested in it and see they give a value to it, companies will be more inclined to do that, more and more of this, right? So I think it's the way you do this, the marks, right? Quality stamps. I think it could be a similar way. There could be an organization who can create those and help people to just use them. Like you have a USDA a stamp for organic thing, right? So you have a similar thing, could be a stamps, which is available, being adhering to those frameworks and getting those stamps going forward.
Yeah, it's almost like, we could potentially build like entire new data constructs, right? Where like important identifiers or metadata actually follows no matter what, right? It's like, you know, it's like you have your data type, but then you have your metadata attached to the data type that no matter where it goes is boop, 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 it's there.
The provenance, right? I think I reposted that in LinkedIn, right? Even the digital provenance, digital signature for your generative AI based, all the outcomes, right? How can you have how can you sign them off? Or can you have a signature of how can you manage the signature? There's a lot of tasks going on in that direction because a lot of fake things are coming out with Gen AI. How do you identify what is fake, what is not fake, and who can control that? And those things are also very critical. So I think the same thing you're saying is a singular direction.
Amazing. What, Shubhrotham, you've got a lot of different things that you're working on. If people want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to reach out?
I think the LinkedIn is the best way, I would say, to connect out, and then we can just have more discussions around it.
All right. And then what are your favorite, for those who are listening, what are your favorite topics that you'd love it when people reach out to you? Like, what are the things you love to discuss?
Yeah, I think I'm right now focusing on three key areas based on my past experiences is Gen AI, obviously. It's the interesting area, Web3. I'm focusing on asset-based tokenization, a little bit more on that. I've been advising companies on that. And the third is gaming. I have priorities, the lower priority is gaming, but eventually I would want to get more in there. I've been building out something of my own, but I guess those are three areas I'm focusing on in that area. So,
well, fantastic. Well, we appreciate you making time today. It's been fun having you on the show.
Same here. Thanks a lot for all the good questions and discussion.
Excellent. We will talk again soon.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for listening and being an advocate of the data culture community. Curiosity intersected with data can inform and inspire change for the betterment of all. Let's build cultures to make this happen. If you have a topic, want to be a guest or chat, reach out to me, Sid Atkinson, or my co-host Lee Harper on LinkedIn via DM or via the Data Culture Podcast LinkedIn group. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so anywhere you get podcasts. Be sure to join our LinkedIn group to engage with your fellow data culture changemakers and visionaries. Thanks again for listening.